Right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Clinton Macomb Public Library's March podcast. We're excited this month to be talking with Rob Hart about his newest book, The Paradox Hotel. So we, of course, have him with us today. My name is Amy. We also have Nicole. Say hi, Nicole.
Hi, Nicole.
And Sarah. Say hi, Sarah.
Hello, everyone.
So we've all read the book. Well, I finished the book and Nicole has finished the book and Sarah's hoping we don't spoil the ending of the book, but I told her I couldn't make any promises about that.
We will do our best.
Exactly.
I've made it about halfway through.
Okay. Well, I hope I stick the landing.
We've told her that you have. So she's excited to read the rest. Yes. So we didn't really plan anything too formal here. We sort of just wanted to talk more organically. And so we're going to start with the very generic question of why time travel and how do you even begin to research that?
Sure. First, real quick, I just want to thank you so much for having me. And just a warning for all listeners, my daughter might pop up at some point and ask a question, and that's okay.
I mean, legit mine too. So
yeah, go do. And on cue, there you are. I don't know. Maybe it's in your backpack, but why don't you go read for a bit? Okay. How about the water on your bedside table?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, there we go. Yeah, I have always loved time travel. It's such a great mechanic because it's so weird. You can have so much fun with it. And, you know, the research element of it is interesting because it's all theoretical. None of it's real. So you really end up in a situation where no matter how much research you actually do, eventually you just kind of throw your hands up and you're like, I'm just going to make it up. But I did read, you know, and I've always been really interested in quantum physics. You know, I've read like Stephen Hawking, you know, a couple of other authors in that field. And there were a few books I picked up in preparation of doing this that were really interesting. And yeah, eventually just got completely overwhelmed by the concept.
That's fair. Even as I was reading the book, I actually listened to the audiobook version of it. And I was like, wait, did I miss something? Do I need to go back? Have we jumped in time? So it makes the book very interesting, of course. So it seems like because you also wrote The Warehouse, which you were kind enough to come and talk to our book club about at one point.
Yeah.
And so when you were talking to our book club about The Warehouse, you pointed out that Gibson, I think his name was, tells this whole false story about when he was younger and he took his parents out to dinner and he, you know, and when I was reading The Warehouse, that was like Gibson's redeemable quality that he had done this. And then you had informed us that it was a lie. And I was like, no, were there any lies that we were told from the characters in this book that we may not have picked up on?
No, I don't think so. You know, this was such a different book because The Warehouse, it was three point of view characters and I was sort of playing them off each other. And it was about like different perspectives. And Gibson in particular was someone who was basically litigating his history and trying to justify everything he had done at that point. So he was building his own legacy and his own myth. Whereas in this, it was solely focused on the main character, January. And she is an unreliable narrator in the sense that she is sort of slipping through time over the course of the story. So there are points where her perception is suddenly, you know, not in the current line of events in the book. So, you know, it was more just like trying to build in this feeling of you're not always sure where she is, but without making it like completely confusing, which is something that me and my editor talked about a lot because initially it was a lot more confusing because I was just like, yeah, people will figure it out. And he read it and he was like, you need to fix a lot of this, dude.
He told you that people would not figure it out.
Oh yeah. No. And he's a really, really brilliant editor. He's such a smart guy. He did like The Martian and Ready Player One and he does Blake Crouch's stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, he's so good at it. Yeah, you know, and that's the thing. That's the challenge with a book like this is you really want to sort of, you know, you want to have your cake and eat it too. You want to do like a really fun, weird, twisty story, but you also want to tell the story that a reader is going to, you know, be interested in and be able to follow. So it's like, it's basically like I'm trying to entertain myself and entertain another reader simultaneously. And it's a fun balancing act because I always want like weird and crazy.
Sure. So how long? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So speaking of your unreliable main character, I was wondering how you came up with the concept of her and why you decided that your sole narrator would be a woman this time.
You know, it's weird. And this is where we get, yeah, and I've talked about this before. It's where we get into sort of like the almost divine nature of the process, in that the through line of the book was like, I got this idea for a time travel hotel. And then I sort of found this comparison in space travel now, where space travel is turning into like a tourism industry for the super rich. And I'm like, oh, if we invented time travel, that would totally happen. And then, you know, at just like space travel is now being privatized, you know, I could see time travel being privatized. And all these pieces were kind of coming together. And, you know, it was a lot of that passive work of the process of just like turning it over in my head. And then just one day kind of got this image of this woman walking off an elevator, and she was wearing a big boho hat and she was really angry and really sad. And I was like, oh, that's my narrator. You know, and within that, I really enjoyed, you know, I've never written an entire book from a woman's point of view before. And I also kind of liked that, you know, she's sort of she's got like kind of like this hard-boiled voice, you know, she's a former time enforcement agent, she's a current house detective. And I feel like those characters are always like big burly dudes. And I was like, you know what? No, like, I feel like it would be more interesting doing this, like, as the point of view from a woman. Not to say that there aren't great women PIs, you know, like Roxanne Weary, Kristen LeBianca's books, like, immediately jumps to mind. Like, she's like a gold standard. But yeah, it was partially just she kind of appeared to me, and partially I really enjoyed the challenge of doing it.
Who do you like better, January from this book, who's the narrator that we're talking about, or Xenia from The Warehouse, who was also a great female character that you wrote?
See, that's tough for me because, you know, part of me is always going to have a sweet spot for Xenia because that was the first female point of view I ever wrote, and I loved her so much. And but then there's the part of me that, like, Paradox is the most recent one, so sure, that's the one that's, like, most on my mind. But it was funny. I don't really get in the habit of rereading my stuff because then I just kind of just see what I would have done differently and I get annoyed at myself. But as part of the promotional run-up for Paradox, my publisher had me go into Goodreads and I did this thing called author notes, where I went into Warehouse and left like notes on the book. So they'll appear to people who are reading it. And I wasn't like doing a close read of the book, but I was kind of skimming it, like, because I kind of knew like where I wanted to put notes and the things I wanted mm-hmm. to do. And like rereading some of Xenia's sections, I was like, oh man, yeah, she was fun. She was such a fun character. You know,
I loved her as well.
Yeah, it was definitely a good time. I miss her.
That's fair.
I feel bad saying this. I haven't actually read The Warehouse yet, so I have to go ahead and say, without a doubt, January is the better one.
That is fair. You can only use the evidence you have.
I loved her. I love that sort of just moody gumshoe sort of just anti-hero character. And there's a part, I'm not going to tell you, Sarah, I'm not going to spoil this for you, but there is a part near the end where you learn something about her that, or she learns something about herself.
I know.
And for a second, you believe that she's the bad guy. Just for a second. And it broke my heart. It really did. Because as moody as she is, and as the way she treats other people because of her own sadness is maybe not the best way, but you still get so into her head and you just want her to be the hero. So I vote for her.
It's hard, Sarah, because you haven't finished.
Well, I mean, we wouldn't want to give away the ending anyway, because there's lots of people out there who haven't read it yet.
That's absolutely true.
But yeah, you know, God, January was so much fun to write because, you know, every book is like me working through something. And, you know, this is a book where I was working through, you know, the difficulty of facing yourself and how hard it is to kind of like take a self-assessment and admit things to yourself. And you know, I really, and so January is a character who, she lost someone that she loved very deeply, and that loss is really sort of metastasized. And, you know, I found this concept called complicated grief, where it's when your grief is so strong that you can't even accept that the person is gone, where you expect them to walk back into the room, where, you know, it's where you really vigorously push people away, and you're just generally hard to deal with. And, you know, it was kind of a tough balancing act, because she really can be a jerk, especially in the beginning. And that's really fun to write, but it's not always fun to read. And so, you know, not only is it finding the right balance, but it's then sort of making sure the reader understands why she is the way she is.
Yeah, she has a line towards the end after a tragic event where I literally was like, oh my gosh, she said it. Like she said that to them. And it, I was like, for a brief second, I was like, do I still like this woman? And then I concluded that I do. But yeah, she's a tough person for sure.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But yeah, God, I love her to death. It's funny where, so the book is being developed for TV, and we just finished the pilot script. This really, really brilliant writer named Jacob Chase put it together. Thank you. So we're now getting into conversations about like who they might be interested in pursuing to play January, which is just the most exciting thing in the world, you know, because there are a lot of actresses who could really kill it at this role, and it would just be really fun to see that.
Do you picture, when you're writing a character, do you picture a certain person who might play them on screen, or does that not even really enter into your thoughts?
I don't really think about it. You know, I think when I'm doing the writing process itself, like I might pull like traits and characteristics from other people, but for the most part, I want it to be, you know, to not feel tied to something. And then it turns into a fun game afterward when it's like, you know, starting to like brainstorm, like, all right, like who's going to do the voice of the robot? Like, that's an important question.
I loved the drone. Was it Ruby? It was Ruby.
Ruby, yeah.
Ruby was one of my favorite characters in the book. I really loved her.
I almost felt like I was cheating, because it's like, you can never go wrong with a quippy robot assistant. Ever.
That's fair.
You know?
I loved her.
What female actress?
Oh,
what
actress
is the Stephen Merchant equivalent?
Like, yeah.
That person.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, I wanted to, it's got to be a New Zealand actor, because I made the robot have a New Zealand accent, because I was like, well, what's the funniest accent? And I say this with a great deal of love and affection. It's the New Zealand accent. So, yeah.
And having listened to this on audiobook, the reader didn't, New Zealand accent.
For, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Because I can't listen to the audiobook.
At least that's what I interpreted it to be. Yeah.
I'm going to have to, I might actually have to listen to one of my audiobooks now. I have such a problem with them, because it's like, and Emily Wu Zeller, who does, she did The Warehouse and she did Paradox. I was so happy she came back. She's so talented. But the thing is like, I have a really hard time listening to the audiobook, because like, it's my words and someone else is speaking them, and it sounds different in my head. And I'm not, and I know other authors who say the same thing. They can't listen to recordings of their work because they're like, that's not my voice. This is not okay. You know, it's vaguely unsettling.
That's fair. I mean, imagine if they place emphasis somewhere where you're like, no, that's not the emphasis of that line of dialogue or something. Even something like that could get annoying.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Because on one hand, like, so my girlfriend is an actress, and she, like, we sat one night with the pilot script, and she did basically a cult read of it, where I read all the directions and she read the dialogue. And it was really cool, because some of the lines in the pilot were lifted from the book, and it was cool to hear how she interpreted them. But it's like, it's something about the narrative of the book that's sure. just like weird.
Fair enough. So we were talking about like random lines in the book that we found interesting. And I don't want to use the term Easter egg, but like, why raptors? Is it a nod to Jurassic Park? Is it because we all know what a raptor is? Because we all saw Jurassic Park at one point, or?
I think so, yeah. Well, you know, the thing is like, it's got to be a small enough dinosaur that you can justify having it in a hotel, but like not completely destroy the hotel. Like a T-Rex would have been too much.
Sure.
And yeah, you know, and I did even make a Jurassic Park reference, because I feel like you can't not do it at that point. But, Yeah, that was such a fun conversation, because when I pitched this book to my agent, I was like, okay, so I'm going to write this book. It's going to have robots. It's going to have dinosaurs. It's going to have time travel, but it's really going to be like a meditation on grief. And he was like, what are you talking about? Don't write that book. Please don't write that book. I'm like, no, it's fine. It's fine. I can pull it off. And he did not believe me. So I went and I did it, and he read it, and he was like, well, okay, I was wrong. But yeah, like I just got this image in my head of like velociraptors stalking a hotel. And I'm like, yeah, I got to put that in the book.
I got to imagine anyone who's listening to this right now and has not read the book and is like, dinosaur, what is happening in this description?
Yeah, it's a weird book. But you know, it's funny, because it's like there are fun elements that I can goof around about and be like, oh, it's robots and dinosaurs and time travel. But it's also, I mean, for me, I think it's the most like earnest thing I've ever written. And so I'm really, really proud of a lot of things that came across in the ending. And, you know, I'm interested to revisit this book at some point once I have a little distance from it, you know, because like now I'm like so sort of deep in like talking about it and analyzing it that like my brain is kind of like a big bowl of like pudding right now. But it's going to be fun to look at this. Or also like, you know, if the TV show goes forward, just to like revisit it from a sense of like how other people are interpreting it.
Well, so speaking of Easter eggs, I did read that the Goodreads commentary that you made, and you mentioned that you had name dropped Margaret Atwood in The Warehouse.
Yep.
And that you were putting in a reference in Paradox Hotel. So at that point, I started reading this book looking for that reference. I assume that you naming the wing Atwood is, yes, your reference to Margaret. The other wing was Butler. Is that for Octavia Butler?
Yes, it was. So yeah, that was, and it didn't really kind of like, it wasn't overt in the book. And I guess, I think it used to be a little bit more overt, but things had to move around and change a bit. But like, you know, one of the ideas in the book is that this woman invents time travel and they still name the time port after Albert Einstein, because, you know, like the government would absolutely do that 100%. You know, I figured like the woman who designed the hotel, who worked with the woman who invented time travel, would say like, you know what, fine, we're just naming everything in the hotel after women. And so that's why it's like the Margaret Atwood wing, the Octavia Butler wing. And then there was the, I cannot believe it, the Ava Lovelace ballroom, you know, like just like, and she wasn't a writer, she was a scientist, but you know, just this idea of like them trying to like claim some agency after, you know, it was basically taken from them.
Yeah, I liked all those references. So thank you. I did too.
Yeah, it was one day I'm going to meet Margaret Atwood and be like, I have made references to you in many of my books. And then she's going to be like, who are you?
Maybe she'll say, I know, I've read them all.
That would be really cool.
I'm here to get my book signed. That's what, right? She'll say.
Good God. Yeah, that's so weird. Like, I remember when Stephen King tweeted about The Warehouse, that was like my buddy text, like I was coming home from the gym and my buddy sends me a text. He's like, you have to get on Twitter now. And I'm like, what did I do this time? What am I in trouble for? And I see the tweet from Stephen King and I'm like, wow, like we didn't even send it to him. He just like must've picked it up in a bookstore.
That's awesome.
And so like, that's trippy when like people you admire for like most of your writing career start reading your stuff. And it's like, uh-oh, I hope they like it.
So speaking of Twitter, at one point you posted a picture of the hotel that you used as inspiration.
Yes.
And I commented that it immediately made me think of The Shining.
Yeah.
And then there's a line in the book that says something like, I'm not going to get it exactly right, but there's nothing scarier than a little girl with dark hair hanging in her face or something like that. Is that a nod to The Shining?
Actually, no. That's just sort of like my constant fear of like Japanese horror movies like The Ring. Sure. And stuff. I'll tell you a really funny story real quick. So I used to work in a bookstore. I was running a publishing company out of the basement, and there was like, and also in the basement there was the storage room for the apartment building over it, and there was this creepy stairwell leading upstairs. And one day I'm walking up the stairwell and there was this girl who had to be like maybe 9 or 10, and she was like, she was a tenant of one of the families, like she lived with one of the families in the building, and she must have been in the storage area. So I'm going up the stairs, she was coming up behind me and she tripped, And I turn around and there's this little girl on the stairs on her hands with her hair in front of her face, like kind of yelling. And I just scream, like scream, scream. And then like she screams because she's like, why is this grown man screaming at me? And then I'm like, I'm screaming at a 10-year-old girl in a stairwell. I got to go. And I just ran, you know, and she was okay. But like, you know, it's actually, it's more of a nod to that moment than anything, because I don't think I've ever been so scared in my life. And I felt so bad.
That's funny.
But creepy kids are creepy.
So the librarian in all of us have had this conversation about your book. It's one of the first, not one of the first, it's one of the only real hybrids. Like, is it in sci-fi? Is it in mystery? Like, where would you expect to find this book on a library shelf?
I don't know. I guess like my whole thing now is just making your job harder. It's weird because I've gone into Barnes & Noble, different Barnes & Nobles and different bookstores, and I found my books in sci-fi, in mystery and thriller, on the general literature shelf. Like, I don't know, the genre stuff is weird to me because it's like, you know, I'm less interested in trying to conform to a genre. Like, I love the idea of like mashing up different things. And it does sort of like, I feel like it does kind of hurt me a little bit sometimes because I've got my foot in two streams, you know, instead of like being like strictly one and easy to categorize, you know, sometimes like it can get lost in the shuffle because people are like, well, is it a mystery? No, not really. It's sci-fi. And then sometimes the sci-fi people are like, well, it's more of a thrill. So it turns into like a weird back and forth.
Well, we just put you in fiction because we can't go wrong.
Yeah.
Which honestly, we were talking about it. And the reasoning for that is that where are people going to go? You know, and if they're looking for you, they're going to look for the warehouse first, which is solidly in fiction. So that's where we put you. But really at this point, it is you and Sarah Gailey messing up our entire thing.
Cool. That is good company to be keeping.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I don't want to take too much more of your time. Do we have any other questions for him, ladies?
I do.
Okay. Cool.
The big thing that I wanted to ask, January is against the idea of meddling with time for good reasons. Yes. When it's her job, she is tasked with making sure that time does not get meddled with. But also, I think on a more like metaphorical level, in order to deal with her grief, she has to be very strong about not thinking that it's possible to go back and save her loved one, you know.
Yeah. And
she has to live with that. But is that your opinion? Is that like, if you could go back in time and stop climate change or stop the Titanic from sinking, is that something that you would do, or do you believe that that's immoral?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I think you can look at it from two sides. You know, like if I'm looking at it from within the world of the book, then I wouldn't do it, because the world of the book very clearly establishes, like, if you go back and make big changes, like, we are all in a lot of trouble. And that was a fun conflict to create with January, where she's like the ace time cop who can't go back and save her dead girlfriend, you know? And so she spends all of her time like 15 minutes away from a device that would let her get this person back. And it's just not going to happen. And she has to, and to her, it's like, you know, if I got to play by the rules, so does everyone else. I'm not giving an inch on this. You know, if you were to look at it in a broader sense, like outside of the world that I made up, like, would I go back and change things? Like, I mean, you know, I would think that this is a really, really interesting question. I really love this. You know, on a personal level, you know, looking back at like mistakes that I've made in my past, you know, would it be nice to go back and change some of them and do them better? Like, sure, you know, but I'm also pretty happy with where I am as a person. So I feel like those mistakes got me to where I am, and changing that might not be great. You know, or, you know, you look at it like, if you had the opportunity to go back and stop the Holocaust, would you stop the Holocaust? And I feel like that should be an easy answer. Like, yes, that's a terrible thing, you know, but then weighing that against like what that could mean for the world. Like, you know, is the timeline going to try to like course correct? Is nothing going to happen? Is something worse going to happen? It's, it's such a weird, weird conversation. This is a conversation that you and I should have, like, with like a bunch of snacks and a bottle of wine and like 6 hours, because like that is, yeah, because that is the best I can match. Like it's a really, really fun discussion, you know, because it's like, it's also because you're playing in such a weird theoretical place, because like maybe you can just go back and maybe it's like a multiverse thing. Like you can go back and change things and explore a different branch of reality and not hurt this one. And yeah. My sci-fi brain is starting to like fire on all cylinders.
Good. We're getting a sequel. I love it.
I do have an idea for a sequel. And I've been dead set against writing sequels for a while now. Cause I wrote a 5-book series and I loved it, but you know, it's a lot to keep track of. And after a while it feels like you're inviting people to a Tupperware party, you know? And then I was like, no, I'm going to write big books that I'm just going to make this big sandbox full of cool toys. I'm just going to blow it up at the end and walk away and go do something else. And then, you know, partly because the TV guy, the guy who's writing the pilot, was like, you know, we're going to be trying to sell this soon. It might not be a bad idea to have a second season idea in our pockets. And even then I was like, yeah, but I don't have an idea. And it's sort of like, I don't know if you're familiar with Doctor Who. It's the Doctor Who problem. It's like the end of every season of Doctor Who. It's like, oh no, the timeline's going to be destroyed. And you can only do that so many times before it's kind of like, you know, okay, guys, find something else. And then like maybe 2 months ago, I just got smacked upside the head with an idea that I was like, oh my God, not only does that work, but like it works well. So, you know, and I sat down with Jacob, who's doing the pilot, and I ran it by him. He's like, oh, that's good. So, you know, it's like this weird space though, because like, unless the book does crazy bonkers business or the TV show gets made, it's probably not worth writing, because my publisher is going to be like, nah, you know? So I'm kind of putting all my energy right now into another project, that, you know, I'm sort of developing and almost done with now, just so I can get started writing it. And the sequel idea is like kind of like cooking on the back of the stove right now. And, you know, I might go to it, or even just revisit it down the line for fun, but yeah, it's a fun idea.
If the TV show gets made, do you know like which service it would be on or which network it would be on or anything like that? Or is you not?
Oh, no, no, yeah. No, nothing. So the way it works, it was optioned by a production company called Working Title. And so they hired Jacob to like write and direct the pilot episode. And so he puts that together. And then once they have the pilot, they try to attach like an actor or two, like someone to play January and maybe like one or two other roles. And then they go to like everybody, you know, Apple, Netflix, Hulu, HBO, the networks, whatever. And it's basically like, you know, okay, who wants to make this? So, I mean, it could end up pretty much anywhere, or it could end up literally nowhere. Sure. Because that's the thing. It's like an option, and you know, so much stuff gets optioned and doesn't necessarily get made. But I gotta say, just like reading a script that someone wrote based on a thing that I wrote was like pretty rad. Daddy. What's up, Kat?
I don't know what that word says.
That is ought. We ought to say. Yes. It means we should.
Okay.
Okay, cool. All right.
All right. Do we have anything else, ladies? No?
I think that's it.
Rob, thank you so much for sitting and talking with us again. We really appreciate it and your continued support of our library and libraries in general. It's always appreciated. For anyone who's listening, make sure you stop into Clinton Macomb Public Library. We have lots of great reading challenges going on for both adults and kids, and we look forward to seeing you. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks so much.